Judy Hoffman, a documentary filmmaker and a teacher of the same here at the University of Chicago. And then next to her is Nori Fujimoto, who's a professor at Fukushima University, works on regional economics. And then next to him is Kennett Benedict, until very recently, publisher of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, still teaches. I'm so glad, even though she's relinquished the directorship of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists to other hands. She continues to be a very important presence here. And Kazu Haga from Oakland, the East Point Peace Academy. In case any of you wonder what that name means, we'll think West Point, the opposite of. And someone who is trained in Kingian, as in Martin Luther King, nonviolence, and has had experience working with nuclear-impacted communities all over the United States for 10 years. So I'd like, if they'd come up maybe to make their initial comments, and maybe just do it in the order listed on the program, and that way everyone can refer back since the nameplates are on the floor at their feet. Not exactly how I planned. And then I think between 12 and 15 minutes the first round, and then we'll have more time afterwards to go back. And so without further ado, Kenneth.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's so lovely to see all of you here today, and also to have the pleasure of sitting with you, listening to comments as the movies were being shown, getting a sense of just how important and long-lasting these issues are. I really just have a few things that I wanted to note today. First, it's clear that the effects of nuclear reactor accidents are incredibly far-reaching. We've centered most of this afternoon's viewing on the health risks to people, especially to children, but to workers, and cleanup crews, especially the cleanup crews now at Fukushima Daiichi plant. They are continuing to work. Some 8,000 or so are still working to try and stop the flow of radioactivity from going into the ocean. They're also haven't even begun to look at what it's going to take to get the reactor, the fuel rods, out of the reactors. This is an ongoing process with far-reaching implications. The effects on the communities, I think we saw really poignantly described and talked about in the films we saw. The agriculture, which especially in Fukushima region, which was one of the most bountiful in the country, has been damaged, and food supplies from that region are really quite diminished. The wildlife and vegetation of the area, and the ocean life from the radioactive water, which continues to flow from the leaking, not only the leaking tanks, but from, as you saw, the groundwater underneath the reactor, which is continuing to be irradiated as it flows under the damaged reactor. And that's affecting fisheries in Fukushima Bay. Fisheries are now absent from that part of the world, and the industry has collapsed. And water from and the radiation from Fukushima is traveling all over the Pacific. Woods Hole Research Institution is tracking this and will continue to track it. It becomes quite diluted by the time it gets to the west coast of the United States, but nevertheless it is and continues to be moving all through the Pacific Ocean. The nuclear industry in Japan has been very much affected, and of course elsewhere. Germany is phasing out its nuclear power program, Italy, Switzerland, and essentially the idea of public acceptance of nuclear power has been destroyed, at least in Western Europe, and I think probably in the United States. The Japanese economy, as you saw, has been terrifically disrupted from a lack of electricity from its nuclear power plants. And perhaps most of all, and I think what came across in the film so well, was the trust in government and in institutions and corporate leaders, even in experts, has been destroyed by these nuclear power accidents. Now, there are countries where nuclear power is continuing to grow, namely China, Russia, India. And they will continue to build nuclear power plants in Russia despite the Chernobyl accident in 1986. The United States, mostly because of the cost of these huge power plants, has been phasing out for some time. Not formally, but I would say that because of the cost and other problems, that will probably continue to decline. And worldwide, we see actually a decline in the nuclear industry since at least about the late 70s, early 80s. So, and a lot of it has to do with cost, but certainly safety is one of the issues, and safety, needing to deal with safety, adds to the cost. I just want to suggest three kind of reflections or lessons that I've taken away from the disaster at Fukushima, and that others have as well. The bulletin in published with Routledge Press an English language version of the only citizen investigation ever of a nuclear power accident, and that was the investigation led by Kitazawa and Yuichi Funabashi, a lawyer and a scientist, who together did 300 interviews of people all through the nuclear accident, and really came up with some interesting observations, many of which you'll find in the book that we helped publish in 2 years ago. But one of them was this idea of the myth of absolute safety. It's kind of a perverse notion. Nuclear power, nuclear energy, is the most destructive technology on Earth. And in order to help people, the public, persuade them to think that this was actually a safe thing to do, they kept saying we've done everything we can to make this safe. You heard this say it on the movie. We've worked very hard to make this safe. And it is so safe that you can live nearby it, you can work in these plants, and we really think these are absolutely safe. And so you have no fear of it. We are all educated here in Japan and elsewhere to think that this was a very safe technology. The problem with it is that the nuclear engineers got caught up in it themselves, so that if you wanted to suggest that there needed to be continuous improvement, for instance, if you wanted to make something safer, then you were admitting that the in the past it wasn't safe. It wasn't absolutely safe. So, for instance, when it came to building the seawall around Fukushima, you heard them talk about the fact that in 2008, TEPCO itself knew that it was possible for a tsunami to breach the walls that they already had. They, in fact, had the money and were talking about putting in a higher wall. One of the TEPCO employees said, who was in charge of community relations in the Fukushima area, said, well, but if we put up a wall, then people will think that the existing plant wasn't safe. So the idea that, and so they didn't. And they'll think that we are more interested in protecting the power plant than in allowing the beautiful view of the ocean from up on the hill. So the idea of absolute safety entrapped people into thinking that it was already safe when, of course, it wasn't safe, and especially not that particular Westinghouse GE model. The second concept, I think, that is well demonstrated by nuclear power plant accidents is that when you have a very complex technology and you've got human beings running it, you're bound to have an accident. It's what Charles Perrow, a sociologist, calls normal accidents. So these aren't really accidents. They are events waiting to be happen. And so to think that we can manage these very technologically complex machineries, these precision tools, as they talked about in the film, it may be just impossible, that it'll be impossible to really have this kind of technology run over many, many operator hours and have it be complete and have it safe in a way that won't cause this disruption. And finally, this is the most dangerous technology that people have invented. It really is. It started with a nuclear bomb, but it's still a very dangerous technology. It's the fire that won't go out, essentially. There is no natural material in the world where you set it on fire and it doesn't naturally go out. Plutonium does not go out for many, many years, 100,000 years. So that if we are to employ or deploy this kind of technology, we have to understand what we're up against. And I think in the end, it just may be too disruptive to contemplate having this kind of technology in our midst. I think the films you saw demonstrated many of these points. But I think these three, the idea of the myth of absolute safety, that normal accidents are really what we're seeing, and that this is the fire that won't go out, all unfortunately were demonstrated much too vividly in the Fukushima disaster, not an accident, a disaster. And of course, we had a chance to hearken back to the Chernobyl accident, which demonstrated also many of these same things. So thank you very much, I'm looking forward to the questions and discussion part of the afternoon. Thank you.
Next, Judy Hoffman. Judy has caught a terrible cold, which I know has been going around, but here she is.
I can get there. Hi, everyone. I want to first thank Norma Field for organizing this, my wonderful co-panelists here. And as a filmmaker, I have to thank the projectionist. Good work. And I want to thank you, all of you, for coming today. So I'm going to speak to film. And to think about these films that we've seen, it may be beneficial to speak first to the documentary genre. Documentary film, the root of it is document, clearly. It's from the Latin, and I'm not sure about the pronunciation, docere. The Latin docere, which means to teach. The OED in 1800 defined documentary as a lesson, an admonition, a warning. A document for scholars is a primary source of information. For lawyers, documentary evidence is provable. The French word documentaire was used to distinguish serious travelogues from scenic fragmented films. There have been many attempts to define documentary. John Grierson, who actually attended this university, coined the term documentary. He describes documentary as the creative interpretation of actuality. There's one for you to ponder. Documentary scholar Bill Nichols considers documentary film a discourse of sobriety that's affiliated with the rational disciplines such as the sciences, economics, and history. At its core, the documentary genre is more about content, subject matter, and information rather than form, style, or pleasure. The documentary trades on a set of relationships to the real people, real places, and events. We recognize the historical world as it is familiar. Because documentary attempts to represent real people within a historical world, the audience, in most cases, accepts its authenticity. There's an unwritten social contract that what has happened in front of the lens is real and or true. But documentaries are constructed. They are films and employ different filmic strategies which can produce different meanings and different knowledge. So for the purpose of my talk, I want to look at each film, note how they are constructed, and consider how meaning is produced. Both Little Voices and Nuclear Japan tell their stories of the nuclear disaster in Fukushima in different ways. However, both films resonate with the beginning definition of documentary: to teach, a lesson, an admonition, a warning. These films function as a warning to the rest of the world about the dangers of nuclear power. Both films serve as consciousness-raising tools, as organizing tools, and also as calls to action. One of the first challenges an independent documentary filmmaker faces is what story to tell. What does an audience need to know? What is active? What is unresolved? And in particular, what is untold by the traditional media? For the directors of Nuclear Japan and Little Voices, this challenge is particularly daunting. How does one speak to the unspeakable? How can they, as filmmakers, make sense of this horrific experience and try to work with an audience towards some kind of understanding? The strategy for these filmmakers was put, the strategy for these filmmakers was to put themselves in the role of both filmmaker and audience and actor. The filmmakers are present in both films as interviewers. Rather than editing out the questions like most traditional interview films, Hitomi Kaminaka, please forgive me, the director of Little Voices, allows her questions to be in the film, creating a conversational style and a sense of equality between interviewer and interviewee. She is also the off-screen narrator, I believe. This participant camera goes further in Nuclear Japan, with director Kawe Hiyoyuki not only narrating some of the film, but he is also on camera conducting the interviews. He directly addresses the audience through performative presentations. Given the strategy of not disguising the maker's relationship to the film, these films become more credible. We, the audience, sense the filmmaker's humanity, know where they are coming from, their point of view. Rather than defaulting to a non-existent voice of God narrator or seamless editing, getting rid of interview questions, our directors present themselves for evaluation and the audience, I believe, accepts them as honest. In the case of Nuclear Japan, Hiroki puts himself on a limb for being both the protagonist asking questions and also the hero, if you will, of the film. Both films provide an array of information. With Little Voices, we have voiceover exposition coming at the beginning and threading through the film, but ultimately focuses on the mothers of the HaHa Rangers as they conduct model programs to provide residents with clean food, a low radiation pathway, recuperation, and evacuation. The film is intimate and highly therapeutic, a view from the ground level where women and children are located. Things that were quotidian are now regarded as special. There are multiple characters, and we are touched by their stories and attempts at agency. Nuclear Japan tells a rather different story or series of stories, also from multiple characters, providing the audience with historic and economic analysis and scientific thought behind nuclear power, the disaster, and the ultimate quest for nuclear weapons. The audience does not linger in the quotidian. Rather, the film is argued like a legal case from rational, measured, likable people. This distanciation from individual empathy or tragedy allows room to evaluate the information given to the audience more thoroughly. Where Little Voices relies on personal stories, Nuclear Japan deploys a multitude of material to prove its case. Archival footage, be it the atom bomb, Atoms for Peace, images of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, television, newsprint, pictures, animation, promotional films, interviews, direct address presentations. Each method establishes visual evidence for the case against nuclear power. Its opening question to the audience, has nuclear power brought us happiness, is never specifically addressed. However, the totality of the film certainly answers no. Thinking about this question posed, has nuclear power brought us happiness, I wondered what things contain the qualities that could provide happiness. That's a very philosophical question that has been taken up by filmmakers such as Jean Rouch, who coined the term cinema verite, whether a person is happy. What is the quality of life? These are the things that make up documentary films. In both films, there's not really a lot of demonstrations or rallies, but they are there suggesting possibilities of people getting together and bodies getting together to be on the street to speak to other people. Chernobyl is treated in both films as a kind of older sibling, older experienced sibling. In the case of Little Voices, it's treated with quite a bit of irony that the Japanese first developed ideas that were deployed to Chernobyl, and now they have to actually have some kind of self-consciousness to think of how what they first developed is now needed for them. Which strangely brings me to the issue of gender. Both films are highly gendered. Little Voices is populated mostly by women of childbearing years and their children. They are victims. They are the bodies that eat and provide and sustain communities and families. Men in that film are the experts in many ways. Although you might say at the ground level the women are the experts, they do go to the male scientists for information. The HaHa Rangers, though, are in this female hierarchy, are in some ways the second tiers. They're higher up than the mothers themselves. They bring the women together, conduct consciousness-raising sessions, and serve as a bridge to recuperation and evacuation. Thus, they are conscious beings and bodies. Through their physical labor, they provide low radiation pathways and disseminate food. The one woman who we see really having agency is the pediatrician, Valentina, from Chernobyl. But she acts in some way as the wise older woman. We do see women approach agency in caring for their families, and being the people who really are the caretakers of health. But it's strange that they don't appear angry in the film. They seem to rather be troubled. Maybe their anger is internal. But essentially, they seemed resigned to their condition. It's very gendered in this way, as is Nuclear Japan, which I'll get to. If Little Voices is the female body, Nuclear Japan is the male head. The film is populated by men, except for one woman at the end who calls for renewable energy. These men are extremely logical and confident. They are the repository of scientific and legal thought, capable of action and change. They are organized in a group, though this group, like their name, is far more serious, not like Haha Rangers. Their group is called the National Federation of Lawyers Against Nuclear Power. And they, in the end, they end up winning the lawsuit. Though we are told throughout both films that the government and scientists mislead and lie, Nuclear Japan is open to some scientists and the court system being on the right side. Through the Fukushima film screen today, we get a glimpse into Japanese cultural issues as they play out over the Fukushima disaster. And as an audience, I don't know about you, but I am always making assumptions. The culture seems highly gendered, with separate spaces for men and for women. People are taught to obey their government. Women are taught to obey their husbands. Shame plays a huge role in decision-making. Government and scientists, as well as academics, mislead and lie. And they attempt to enforce normalcy and continue the myth of nuclear safety. It is said in Nuclear Japan that nobody wants to remember. However, it is impossible to forget. In the end, what I was most struck by was that in Little Voices, there was only one reference to nuclear power. Mostly it was called the earthquake. It is still so difficult to speak to the unspeakable. I was also stunned at how the quotidian becomes dangerous. Air drying your clothes, drinking milk, walking barefoot on the grass, picking raspberries. What was once imbued with pleasure that made you happy may now kill you. In the end, what was most disturbing to me were the images of black plastic bags, like body bags for the earth, lined up to be taken away to who knows where, disappeared like the countryside. The power of cinema, to me, is in these shots. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Judy. Next, Kazu.
Thank you. I want to preface this by saying that I'm not an expert in nuclear technology. I'm definitely not an expert in Fukushima. As Norma mentioned, whatever expertise I have is mostly around urban peacemaking and violence prevention work. I work mostly with incarcerated communities in California and young people. But I've been involved in many different social justice movements and organizations for the last 18 years. So I want to speak more from the perspective of not as an advocate for nuclear nonproliferation or an expert on environmental issues, but as an advocate for social justice issues. I think when most people think about nuclear disasters and the harm that comes from the nuclear industry, I think we mostly think of images like this. You can't see, the bottom seems to be a little cut off, but this is obviously an image of the bombing of Hiroshima in 1945. We also see images like this, Chernobyl in 1986. And, of course, we see images of Fukushima in 2011. But one of the harms, or some of the harms that we don't see, are the day-to-day harms that aren't associated necessarily with these types of accidents and disasters. This is the United States nuclear roadmap. And it may be hard for some people to see because a lot of the images are a little small, so I want to highlight a few things here. These are all of the nuclear power plants that exist in the United States. This is as of 2013, so a couple of them have been decommissioned since then. And then the next one, these are all of the nuclear reactors that exist in research and testing facilities around the country. And the next one are all of the decommissioned nuclear power plants in this country, a lot of them which still carry or which still store radioactive waste. These are all of the military facilities that store nuclear weapons. And I don't know if you saw the little pink thing in the bottom is an underground facility in New Mexico, the Waste Isolation Power Plant, which stores a lot of radioactive waste from around the country. These are the uranium deposits in the 48 states. Contiguous, thank you. That's the word I was looking for. And finally, these are the transportation routes that the industry uses to carry uranium waste, all sorts of radioactive material. So these are all of the areas where there could potentially be an accident. It's not just in these isolated places that we think of, nuclear power plants and so on. But like I said, I want to talk a little bit more about the harm that is happening every single day outside of these major accidents. The organization that I used to work for back in 2002 was looking at this map, and we realized that real harm was happening every single day along much of this nuclear life cycle. And so we started an initiative called BACE, which stands for Building Action for Sustainable Environments. And it was a 10-year initiative that I coordinated from 2002 till 2012. And the BACE initiative was really unique in several areas. One more. So first of all, the Peace Development Fund was a foundation. We gave grants and capacity building trainings to grassroots social justice organizations around the country. And as a foundation, we were using the BACE initiative to explore what it means for a foundation to share power with our grantees. And what does it look like to try to build relationships that aren't based on the money that we give away? And how do we really have equitable relationships between the funder and the grantees? This was also an intentionally multiracial coalition. So it was 14 different organizations, including black communities from the rural South, Native American communities from reservations, Latino communities from farmworking communities in the Pacific Northwest, using our culture and our spirituality as the strength and the foundation of how we were going to go about our work. It was also an intergenerational initiative. And so the youth component of the BACE initiative was led by the children and oftentimes the grandchildren of the elders who led the entire initiative. So we were using our family structures, again, as the strength of the initiative. But perhaps most importantly, we were bringing together communities that lived along every chain of the every link of the nuclear chain. So communities that live near the uranium mines, all the way to the research and facility sites and the storage sites and the nuclear waste facilities. Because again, we saw that along every single link in that chain, people were being harmed and there were injustices occurring every single day. So I want to highlight just a few examples of that. This is a picture of a uranium mine taken in 1953 on Diné land, on Navajo land. And when you look at this image, do you all notice something strange? Does anything come to mind for you? No safety equipment at all. They're not wearing masks. I think one of them might be wearing a glove. But if you can go to the next slide. This is a picture of a man named Milton Martinez who I met in 2002. And he used to be a uranium miner. His father, his uncles, his whole entire family used to work in the mines. And they said that when the United States government discovered uranium on their lands, they employed a lot of the Navajo people to go mining in them, and they didn't say a single word about the potential hazards of working in these mines. So they were working in these mines with absolutely no safety equipment at all. Milton himself has lost his father and both of his uncles to cancer. And you can see this picture is a picture that I took in 2004. And this is one of the many, the hundreds of mines that exist on Navajo land. And as you can see, there's no fence there. There's no warning sign. This particular mine was probably about 50 yards from his house, where his children play, where his animals graze. And this is in 2004. I was at his house. You can literally, he showed me, walk right outside of his house and pick up a rock that has uranium in it today. That still exists today. If you can go to the next slide. This is a protest that we were a part of outside the Nevada test site, which was also the proposed site of the Yucca Mountain nuclear waste storage facility, which is no longer going to happen because there was so much public pressure against it. But I want to talk a little bit about what goes on that land even today. If you can go, I think, two slides. The Treaty of Ruby Valley was a treaty that was signed in 1883 between two sovereign nations, the United States federal government and the western band of the Shoshone Nation. And this treaty covered about 40,000 square miles of land between Nevada and Utah, and it gave full control and ownership of that land to the Western Shoshone Nation, which again is a sovereign nation. Despite the presence of this treaty, in 1951, the Department of Energy created the Nevada National Security Site, which is also known as the Nevada Test Site. And since 1951, there's been almost 1,000 nuclear tests conducted on that land, which makes the Western Shoshone land the most bombed nation on Earth. Obviously, studies have shown high rates of many different forms of cancer on that land. And one of the things, I didn't have the exact numbers, but one of the things about this study was done on Mormon communities that live near the Nevada test site. And they showed high rates of cancer in the Mormon communities, but they didn't study the Western Shoshone people who lived on that land. And the native people who live on that land are much more, their lifestyles are much more reliant on their natural environment, right? They're much more likely than Mormon communities to hunt and live off of the land, to have animals that graze there, to farm on that land. And so the presumption is that cancer rates on native communities are much higher than that research showed. And just as a reminder that according to U.S. and international law, the Treaty of Ruby Valley is still in effect. So every single day that goes by that the Nevada test site is still there is in violation of an international treaty. I want to talk about another report that was conducted in 2008 by the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health. They studied thousands of workers that were employed at five different nuclear facilities from the 1940s to the 1990s. And these are the five sites that they studied. The three sites in bold, Hanford, Los Alamos, and the Savannah River site, are three sites where the BASE Initiative had member communities living near those sites. The study monitored 94,517 workers who worked at these facilities, and found that 257 of those workers died from leukemia. That's about 0.272% of the population that they monitored, which doesn't sound that high until you look at some numbers from the National Cancer Institute that shows that in 2015, about 24,450 people living in the United States will die from leukemia. And that is a 0.00789% fatality rate. So you can see that if you work in these facilities, obviously your chances of getting ill and potentially even dying goes up by quite a bit. So you can see that, and I actually got to take a tour of the Savannah River site a few years ago. And one of the reasons why we were able to do that was because our local base member who lived around the Savannah River site in Aiken, South Carolina, had a really close working relationship with the Savannah River site. And a lot of the members of that organization talked about the challenges of fighting nuclear technology and knowing that their community was getting sick because of the presence of the Savannah River site. And at the same time, as an impoverished community, knowing that working at the Savannah River site was one of the only sources of employment for their community. And so this isn't just an environmental issue. It's also an economic justice issue for communities that have no option than to go work in the mines and to go work in these facilities. These are just some images of a delegation that we sent to Copenhagen for the United Nations Climate Change Summit in 2009. One of the discussions that's happening around the world right now is the attempt to try to sell nuclear energy as a solution to climate change. And the two arguments that we really brought to the table in Copenhagen was that, a lot of the studies that show that there's no carbon emissions in the nuclear cycle ignores the entire life cycle of the nuclear industry. So they ignore the carbon emissions associated with the mining and the tilling of the uranium, the transportation, the construction and the decommissioning of nuclear power plants. But also to remind people that there are communities that are still being harmed today, every single day around the country, from nuclear technology. And so this idea that there's a peaceful use for nuclear technology is not realistic. For the communities that have to live near these sites, this technology is never going to be peaceful. And so for people to start thinking about and talking about a second wave of nuclear buildup, when the communities that have been harmed by the first wave haven't even been addressed, we think is an injustice that can't go on. So nuclear technology in this country isn't just an environmental issue. It's an economic justice issue. It's a social justice issue. And I want to tie that back to what happened in Fukushima a little bit. Right after the incident in Fukushima, I was part of a small group of people in the Bay Area that started something called the Japan Multicultural Relief Fund. A lot of people don't realize that Japan is not an ethnically homogenous country. Japan actually has a lot of different communities that live there, non-national ethnic minorities as well as domestic ethnic minorities and other underserved communities. The non-national ethnic minorities is something I want to touch on a little bit because the Japanese Constitution only gives rights to Japanese nationals. So if you're a non-national living in Japan, you don't have constitutional rights. And specifically, I want to talk a little bit about Korean and Chinese communities, because a lot of Korean and Chinese communities living in Japan have been there for 5-6 generations, and they still don't have citizenship. So they're not considered nationals. I think the next slide is a video. Before you go there, I just want to show a 1-minute video to give some context to what some of the things that Korean and Chinese communities have to live through in Japan. And I just wanted to say this quickly before we start the video. It's a minute long, but it can be very triggering. Some of the hate speech that happens very regularly and consistently in Japan these days it's pretty scary stuff. So it's only a minute long, but if you feel like it, feel free to close your eyes. It's subtitled, or if you speak Japanese, to try not to listen or whatever, but it's just a minute long, and I feel like it is important for us to understand the context of what these communities have to live through. So, go ahead. And this is outside of a Korean elementary school. Shinokubo is the Korea town in Tokyo. So I just wanted people to get some sense of the context in which the disaster at Fukushima happened and the recovery is happening. You can't talk about what happened with Hurricane Katrina in the United States without talking about racial justice. And it's similar in Japan. Because of a lot of the racism and the xenophobia that exists in Japan, a lot of ethnic minority communities suffered disproportionately from the Fukushima disaster and have trouble accessing resources in the recovery because of that. There was a statistic that came out that actually showed that if you were a non-national, you were twice as likely to die because of the Fukushima disaster than nationals. There's been a lot of reports in the media that kind of target non-Japanese communities as thieves that are trying to loot post recovery, very similar to what happened in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. And so the Japan Multicultural Relief Fund was raising money in the United States to support organizations doing work in Japan specifically to work with ethnic minorities and other underserved communities. A couple of the things that we did was we raised organizations to support, we raised funds to support 7 organizations doing that work in Japan. One of them was able to start a multicultural or multilingual community center that was connecting people to resources that offered resources through different languages, different culturally appropriate ways. Created a multilingual hotline that was also connecting people to resources. And of course, breaking bread and feeding people and building communities in that way. So just a few things in closing for now. I think it's important that we acknowledge that the harm that comes from the nuclear industry isn't just related to these accidents and disasters, but people are being harmed every single day from this industry. That there are no peaceful uses of nuclear technology, that if you live along the nuclear chain, that you're being harmed by that industry every single day. And because of that, the nuclear issue shouldn't be viewed just as an environmental issue, but it is an economic justice issue, it is a racial justice issue, it is a social justice issue. And the non-proliferation of nuclear technology, we need to really empower the communities that are most directly impacted, and oftentimes it's communities that are already being underserved, it's communities that are already suffering from things like racism, economic injustice. We really need to empower those communities and go at it with a larger analysis than it just being an environmental issue, but a larger social justice issue. So I'll close with that for now, and I look forward to the discussion later.
And so now, Nori Fujimoto.
Hello, good afternoon. My name is Nori Fujimoto from the University of Fukushima. And I really want to express my thanks to Emeritus Professor Norman Field for giving me the opportunity to make a presentation here. And I was not born in Fukushima, but I've been in Fukushima for 10 years, since 2006. And at the time of the nuclear explosion, I experienced the nuclear disaster and big earthquake in Fukushima Station. And the disaster, especially the nuclear disaster, still goes on. And a few years ago, little people knew the name of Fukushima, I guess. But now, the name of Fukushima has been spread worldwide, and maybe most of you know the name of Fukushima here. Yeah. Today, I have some comments about the problem of the now government, central and local government's policy. About the recovery of the recovery, sometimes called rebuild, recovery and rebuild policy for the nuclear disaster. From the a comment from the comment after I watched the movie. And I named the reconstruction policy of Fukushima as decontamination project, decontamination-oriented project. Now, decontamination project, as recorded in both movies, in progress, as if do good things as soon as you can, or make hay while the sun shines, and as if an all-round medicine. And this means don't escape from Fukushima, especially central Fukushima, because Fukushima is safe with decontamination project. And this also followed by many small budget or reconstruction policy, followed by they fired the decontamination project and reduction of evacuation. The main policy is here, promotion of decontamination. And there are many small policies like promotion of the robot industry in Fukushima, or opening highway even in evacuation zone. And go back in your village campaign to be back in Fukushima is beautiful things. And campaign to say Fukushima's products are safe, or a specialized zone for agriculture and fishery. And this project includes visa exemption for Chinese tourists in Fukushima. Before entering the main point, maybe most of you don't know the decontamination protocol. What is the decontamination project here? Firstly, to remove the radioactivity materials, contaminated materials, on and in the soil by air and water pressure, so very classical way. Mm-hmm. And after that, the soil, including the polluted material, is moved and collected from the original place to the other point. But in Fukushima's case, the removed materials is still located in the same house. Difficult to understand by what, seeing the buildings. Yeah, this is easy to understand. This is my university, Fukushima University, building of the Fukushima University. And this is nearest railway station. And housing. And this is a small garden compared to the United States, very small garden. But this debris covered with plastic bag here, with blue plastic sheet here. Debris, including radioactivity and materials, and after remove the soil of the land. But we cannot send back this debris to TEPCO's plant, because in Japanese law, substance or material from the sky must be held by the landlord or owner. It's funny, funny law, but now every house must keep their polluted materials from the TEPCO plant in their house. It's funny. And especially recorded in the second movie, Little Voices, the most big problem in Fukushima is shown in this figure and in this table. In Belarus, influenced by the Chernobyl accident, they decided a zone with more than 5 millisievert as a right to replace residents to other place. And the zone, this is called as the zone of priority resettlement. But in Japan, under below 20 millisievert per year, annual dose rate, under 20 millisievert, there are no compensation, no right to move to other area. And the only compensation from the TEPCO is 800 US dollars for one person. And, in the movie, pregnant lady or children have a compensation about 9,000 Japanese, but only once. Instead of the evacuation and compensation from the TEPCO and the government, the only way for recovery and rebuild of Fukushima is decontamination project. Fukushima is divided into two. One is the evacuation zone here, covered by orange line. And the other area, Fukushima City and Fukushima University is located here, Fukushima City. And 60 kilometers from the plant here. And no compensation no right to resettlement. Chicago University is famous for the birthplace of the nuclear technology. And almost every university with science department has an X-ray room, radiation control room like this. And I took this picture in Colgate University in New York State, but 5 hours car driving from the New York City, and very rural area. And my friend belongs to the Colgate University, and I took this picture in the Colgate University. And this is dose rate, the same one I recorded in the Little Voices. A wider map is here. Pollution of the radioactivity is not limited to the within the boundary of Fukushima Prefecture. Outside of Fukushima Prefecture, next to neighborhood prefecture, many hotspots green painted zone. And this is the latest map I picked up 1 week ago from the ministry, from the home website of the Ministry of the Environment in Japan. I'm basically an economist, regional economy, and we didn't learn a lesson from the Chernobyl. But in Japan, governmental TEPCO want to reduce the area of the evacuation, increase decontamination project. On the contrary, Belarus or Ukraine stopped decontamination project, and they made decision to people for relocation and or building a new city in other area. This is my hypothesis. This is my research works. My hypothesis is here. If the normal guidelines apply to the Fukushima accident, the radioactivity below 5.2 millisievert per year, smallest estimation, but at least more than 0.8 million people have to take refuge from the Fukushima Prefecture. Now, the fiscal budget in the red, especially central government, cannot afford to support the compensation even for 0.8 million refugees from the middle of Fukushima. That's why the contamination project is in progress in Fukushima, in my view. And this scenario one is taking action, and only 20 millisievert under 20 millisievert no. Problem is not safe. Is said by the government of PEPCO, and only 18,000 refugees can get the compensation, especially within the 20 kilometer radius. But if we make the circle wider, 80 kilometer radius, like including of course my city, Fukushima city. At least evacuation will be more than 1 million. If we apply the normal guideline, 1 millisievert, more than 1 millisievert is dangerous, and we have to keep away from the area polluted with more than 1 millisievert, 3 million people have to escape from Fukushima. It's, of course, physically it's possible, but financially and economically it's impossible. And there are many misunderstandings about Fukushima. There is no, and all of them read, misread, and all of them read, we cannot escape from Fukushima and keep stay in Fukushima. But this is misconception. Popular misconception about Fukushima is here, 1, 2, 4. And there are limited land supply, no room for making a new city. This is untrue. Before the earthquake and the nuclear plant, Fukushima and Sendai, neighborhood government, always preparing for the wide land for the national capital function movement, national capital location. They always told us we can accept 1 million people, always. And in Japan is a highly industrial and manufactured country, but in Fukushima, Tohoku district, or Hokkaido, North Japan, there are many room and density of population is not so high. Maybe as large as that of Illinois, not so high density of population. And much room for making new city, much land in North Japan, especially in Fukushima or Sendai. And population density in Fukushima is not high. And some scholars say economic system is different from the Soviet and the former Soviet Union and Japan. This is actually untrue. Every economic system in the world has two aspects. One is planet economy, and the other is market economy, free economy. And in Fukushima, 40% of the industry are very closely related to the government payment, government procurement. And the fourth is also misconception. Japan has a very long history, and empire's family continue for more than 140 generations. I remember, maybe. But, of course, emperor has long history, Japan has long history. But only 90% of Japanese could get land after World War II, especially after land reform triggered by United States, GHQ. And only 10% of Japanese people are keeping the ancestral land for generation by farmer. We learned land reform after World War II in the textbook of elementary school. But almost all people forget about this land reform after World War II. And also many economists attend this hypothesis. To stop supply chain in Tohoku region is unreal decision. But the traffic flow in Fukushima or Sendai in North Japan, very little. Not so high. If we stopped highway or high-speed railway, it's called in Shinkansen in Japan. And if we stop the high-speed transportation, there are many services like ferry or air. And this is also mythology. Okay, beyond this conception, I would like to talk this my suggestion and comments. There's no scientific evidence to say if Fukushima is yes or not, as shown in especially Little Voice. No linear relationship between radiation and sickness. Small radioactivity may affect our body or not. But It's certain that percentage of the disaster in high radioactivity contaminated zone will be high. It's certain. The second suggestion is that the true story of Fukushima has been hidden by the decontamination project. It's overestimation of the decontamination. And 2 years ago, I bring Fukushima University student to the Winsconi University, by way of Chicago Airport. And we went to Winsconi University Medicine School and all subsidized, supported by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Japan. And of course, under the control of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, their presentation recommended decontamination, and with decontamination, Fukushima, you say, and please come to Fukushima. They recommend it. But don't overestimate decontamination. And the third suggestion is that repeal the cabinet decision boundary of evacuation, especially for it followed ICR, as you know, ICRP's guideline under 20 meters sievert is said to be safe. And the fourth one is give the right to resettlement and escape from Fukushima covered with more than 5 meters sievert, as large as the X-ray, medical X-ray. And no way to solve the nuclear accident. If the same thing happened in Japan, economically, there's no way to save Fukushima. And the national economy of Japan will not be able to save the nuclear accident financially. Well, no, even global economy cannot save the nuclear accident in advanced countries like Japan or European country, so Japan, yeah. Well, Australia has no nuclear plant, but in advanced countries, nobody will never be able to save the nuclear accident financially. And now I'm the associate professor of Fukushima University. But from next month, I will move out of Fukushima and I will move in another university located in Tokyo, not Tokyo University, a university located in Tokyo, next to Tokyo University, very close. Same word, Bunkyo, it is called same word. And if you have any question about me, I will be engaged in the Fukushima problem after I leave Fukushima, and don't hesitate or send an email to me, and don't hesitate to ask me. Thank you for your listening.